Blog Talk Radio.
King Street, DC Metropolitan News and Real Estate Information.
Welcome to the King Street Great Wednesday listening audience. I'm your host, King. And how you doing, Mr. Smith?
How you doing? Well, King.
Great. Great to be here. Great to have another show. Looking forward to today's discussion. And so as we like to start off each show, kind of with our gratitude moments, what we're grateful for, I want to begin the show with what I'm grateful for: my life, my health, my ability to see, hear, walk, talk, stand, breathe, and have a sound mind. And I'm grateful for all the love and support from my friends and family members, and another 24 hours to pursue my purpose in life. What's your gratitude moment, Mr. Smith?
Yeah, so, you know, I did all what you said as well, King, but I think I'm grateful for relationships today. You know, relationships is a two-way street, so it's you're bringing value and adding value, but then also, you know, it's having people that you can depend on in times of need. And so I'm grateful that I do have relationships where people can depend on me and I on them, which is a wonderful thing in these trying times.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And these, as you talk about these trying times, you know, how are you dealing with this pandemic and this lockdown, being in home with family, you know, for most of your time now? How are you adjusting to that?
You know, King, it's been great. It's been wonderful. I mean, you know, we're eating at home all three meals, which is rare because of the
right.
schedules that I keep, and, you know, with travel and the different demands of meetings and conferences, that's rare. And so we're able to connect on that level. My wife and I are meal planning. And so before we go out to the store, we're kind of laying out the meal, and we have different themes. You know, this is my wife. This is not me. But she has different themes for different nights, right? So we're doing Italian one night, and we're going to the Orient another night, and we're doing Caribbean. And so it's been fun. We've been creative in these times. But in terms of business, man, I've been so productive. And being able to schedule my times and still being able to exercise and still get the family time in, which is, you know, things that tend to be a challenge when I'm not at home as often as I am now. So we really made the best of this time.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I was chuckling to myself when you talked about eating all three meals at home, because I find myself cooking a lot more than I've ever cooked, as far as consistently that I've been, because I haven't eaten out probably in about 7 weeks, because, you know, I'm a little nervous about eating out. I'm like, I don't really trust that until we get more tests done. I don't trust fast food providers to have tested their workers to just, you know, take the risk of bringing in that food. So I rather cook myself, and I'm rather enjoying it. So there are some good things about this fourth stay at home. I agree that, you know, it definitely gives you more time to reflect, at least for me, think about either obviously reposition my business model quite a bit, because my business model definitely was more meetings in person, tours and gatherings and events. So now things got to be done virtually. So that's a shift in that kind of a focus. But it's a nice shift. It's a welcome shift. But one of the things I will share with you before we get too much deep into the show that I really do like about the environment that we're in right now is how level the playing field is. And what I mean by that is, you know, like the talk show hosts like Jimmy Fallon, Steve Colbert, Trevor Noah, Jimmy Kimmel, you know, nobody's really watching those shows live. So what they're doing now, since they're not in the studio, they're basically shooting their home, their shows from their home. And so now they put them into the competition of having to compete with all the other YouTube show content creators out there. And just watching their viewership, you know, for somebody who gets paid, you know, more than $20 million a year to do a show with all the advertisers and big budgets, when you put them on a YouTube platform, they only get 100,000 views, you know. So it's just interesting just seeing how when you put people all on a level playing field without the advertisers, the big show runners to put your show out there, and you got to compete with other folks just on content creation, subject matter, and your charisma, you know, I think it makes a very interesting time that we're in right now.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, and I know this is kind of a sidebar, but I like it because it's real. Like right now we're in a disruptive time, so, you know, as people are starting to coin the new normal. So I know it's a real estate show, but it's really about life as well and how we consume our content. My wife and I actually was having this conversation just last night as we were flipping through the different late-night channels, and we ended up landing on Steve Colbert. And what we realized is even the jokes are different, right? The level of preparation that goes in when you have that big staff. And I asked my wife, I said, well, why do you think they're not as funny? and I think it's because, as you said, because things have changed. Everything is being done remotely. So when you have a staff of, you know, 40 or 50 people that's writing jokes and writing storylines and all those things kind of for you, and you just come in and you perform, it's a lot different, right, than when you have to go back to. And all those guys, you know, they were stand up and they did a lot of things before the bright lights. The reality is you kind of got to go back to what they used to do years and years ago. And some of them, to be quite honest with you, they're not as good as they used to be, you know, with the improv and the various components that we're dealing with in this era. So it's definitely a different time.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, that's a perfect segue into, you know, how important, you know, choosing the right property is in times like now. I mean, if you're in a situation where you're in a house that you either purchase yourself as a home buyer and you say, I was going to use it temporarily to get to the next level, really didn't like it much, and you probably say to yourself, I'm going to spend a lot of time in the office and working and only be home enough just to eat and sleep. Now you're forced into a reality where now you're home 90% of your time. And if you don't like your house, you don't like your neighborhood you chose, you just got to deal with that, you know. And that's such a key piece to, for me, when it comes to even choosing real estate investment deals. Like, I approach each deal with the mindset of, do I want to live there? You know, and because if I refuse to put people in housing that I would not live in, you know, and most people who know that the Roundtable's model of buy the block properties, you know, buy the block strategy is that, you know, as we begin to start developing blocks, I'm going to live in one of those properties for about 6 months to a year just to get comfortable with the neighborhood, the mores of the community, the culture, to see if it's violent, to see if it's loud, to see if it's neighbors that talk all night, or what kind of energy is created among the block from folks who are entrepreneurs on the block. You know, I want to see all that, because that's going to be key to being able to attract community stakeholders who are our tenant buyers to live in these properties, and then make sure they are safe and make sure they're comfortable and that they want to go through with the home buying process in the allocated time that we have specified. So now, being in a home now, you know, fortunately for us, our motto is really building quality homes, renovating houses that, you know, and it's not a lot of different developers and renovators may have a different philosophy towards this, but like we approach a house, the uglier the better, you know, so that we can just go in, do a full gut, make sure we're not just encapsulating lead-based paint, you know, we're taking everything out. Everything's new. New floor joists, new walls, new roof, new mechanics. Everything's new. So you don't have to worry about any existing mold or environmental issues, new house. So all that being said, the house I'm in now, even though it's a temporary residence because I'm going to be moving out of it soon to move into another block, but I don't mind being in this house that I'm in now for 23 hours or like I haven't even been out the house this entire week, and I'm comfortable being in this house. And that's why I believe that's so important when choosing a house as either a home buyer or investor. It all starts with the neighborhood, you know, and making sure that the neighborhood that you're choosing and the blocks that you're choosing on those neighborhoods and when within those neighborhoods are blocks that you can build from and blocks that you feel that there are at least some kind of core elements to build from.
Yeah, no, I think that's important. You know, when you're evaluating and you're selecting properties, whether from an investor perspective or someone that's going to actually reside in the house, you know, it's almost like dating in a scenario where, you know, you look for certain characteristics. You know, some people, you know, whether it's height or you know, certain things that may attract you to the opposite sex. You know, as it, you know, so it is as it relates to properties. It's every house, it's not a one size fit all, and every neighborhood is not a one size fit all. And so, what are those things that are important to you? And so, I think what you're saying is it requires some introspect, right? It's not just, you know, well, this house is available, I should buy it. It's an introspect. Does this house fit your criteria? Does it fit your needs in terms of space, in terms of, you know, and I like to introduce something that I use, you know, called a real estate life cycle, you know, and the way I define the real estate life cycle is you're buying this property today, but what is the full life cycle as this property is under your stewardship? And so will it be something that you'll buy today as an investment property, as a buy and hold? Would it be a buy and flip? Is it something that you would rent out, you know, for the next 10 to 15 years? And then think about each of those aspects and who would play the vital roles in helping you carry out that life cycle. So if it is a buy and hold, for instance, you know, who's my renovation team? Who's my construction team? You know, who's my agent? Do I need a property manager? You know, do I have the skill sets that's required to maintain this asset over the next 10 or 15 years? And so I think when you think about it in that way, in terms of a life cycle, I think you're more likely to make a selection that's consistent with the goals that you're trying to accomplish. And you're thinking about it more in a long-term sense than in the short term, because it may fulfill one requirement in terms of, does it provide a safe place for your family? But what's going on in the neighborhood? You know, what are the projections? Is this a fully developed neighborhood? Is this a neighborhood in transition? What's the proximity to work and to other conveniences, grocery stores and hospitals and things that people value when they're renting a property? So if it transitions from my primary house to now an investment property, you know, will it still fit that criteria for what other renters are looking for? And so when I think about the real estate life cycle as to, you know, how long will I be a steward of this property and how many of those different scenarios or situations I can address up front when I buy the property, and I think it's more likely that I'm going to be happy over the time that I own the house versus it's just serving a short-term need.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And with that being said, so let's kind of delve a little deeper into your methodology when it comes to selecting properties and deals. So which you've been primarily living in the Prince George's County area, but having some familiar roots and done some business here in Baltimore City, what would you say are some of the driving factors that would make you consider a certain neighborhood in Baltimore? You know, because Baltimore obviously is divided into east, west, north, south, you know, So would you approach it from, I'm only going to invest in East Baltimore, West Baltimore, or I'm going to invest citywide as long as the property produces a certain cash flow? You know, kind of what is your methodology for choosing where do you want to invest in the city?
Yeah, for me, King, it's one is opportunity, right? So where are the opportunities? Where are the opportunities today? Like, where are the buying opportunities where I can acquire a property? There's a good turn on investment, a reasonable return on investment. And then what are the contributing factors, right? So what is going on in that neighborhood, in that area? What is the anchor that draws people to that neighborhood or that area? And then how sustainable is that for short-term, long-term? So, for instance, you know, if we're talking about, you know, in Baltimore, if we're saying, you know, like East Baltimore, we're saying the John Hopkins area, right? If there's a lot of people that flock there for investment opportunities, is okay, so is there, if this is a buy and hold strategy, you know, is there a workforce development part here? So can I rehab this house and potentially rent them to employees of the hospital, you know, whether it be doctors or nurses or support staff, you know, of the hospital? So I think a lot goes into, you know, my consideration as to not only is there a buying opportunity, but what is the end goal? Like, the person who I'm thinking about who would buy this house and or rent that house, where is that person now? Is that person currently living in the neighborhood that this property is located? Or is the neighborhood a transition neighborhood? And if it is, where are people transitioning from, right, to come to this particular neighborhood? What are the draws of this particular neighborhood and area? And I think then it will start clear to me is who is that target that I'm looking for once this house is renovated and completed? Because that's going to make it a lot easier for me to advertise and to market to that person once I understand who that is. But again, that's part of the life cycle. I'm considering all these factors prior to making a buying decision.
Right. Right. Now, with that being said, have you ever purchased properties as an investor from a email that someone sent you, you know, like join all these different meetup real estate groups, or, you know, get on an email list of different real estate investors and the wholesalers, they start to send you properties and they send you properties with pictures of the property and they estimated repair value, and then the after repair value, and then you estimate a repair. So have you ever purchased a property in that process before? Or, and if not,
yeah,
would you purchase a property
So I think, you know, it's a good question, but, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with purchasing property. I think there's several different ways to acquire property. And as you mentioned, wholesale is one of them. And I don't want to just assume that people understand what we're saying when we throw these terms around, but wholesale is, think about BJ's. Think about a company that have access to manufacturers, and they typically buy in bulk. And because they buy in bulk, they get a reduced rate. And so what you would pay for in the grocery store, because Costco's and Sam's order so many of them, they're able to get it at a much cheaper price. And so theoretically what happens is then they can pass that savings on to you as a consumer. And so that's what wholesale, as it relates to real estate, is someone has a relationship with the seller and they have agreed contractually that they will go out and either market the property to be able to find an end user buyer, and in some cases they may buy it themselves, but the idea is they're buying it typically below market rate, and because of that cost savings that they have been able to acquire with that contract with the seller, then they could pass that savings on to you. So this might be an opportunity where you could buy a property for less than market value. Must have market value, but also it may minimize the competition because it doesn't go on the MLS, the multi-listing service, so maybe you're not competing with hundreds or even thousands of other buyers. You know, it may be a situation where you could swoop in, buy the property really quickly, and be able to save some money. So absolutely, I have sold properties in that way through untraditional ways, including wholesaling, as well as purchased properties that way. And I think that that is one of several ways that we acquire properties. And you mentioned the list, and so I'm probably on, you know, a couple hundred lists. And people, it's not probably not a day that goes by that people don't send me properties or call me about properties that I have the opportunity to purchase. So I don't think so much it is the supply or where the property comes from is what I would focus on as much, because there's several different outlets. I would focus more on what is your purchase strategy? What is your process? Like, how do you evaluate this property? How do you peel the onion back once you get a listing or once someone sends you a wholesale property? You know, what is your process for determining should you move forward on the purchase? I think that is the critical part of consideration that, to be perfectly honest with you, as I talk to investors, I'm surprised to find that many of them do not have a hard, fast process or strategy when they approach buying real estate.
You're absolutely right about that. And for me, I have seven steps that I use to determine whether or not I'm going to buy real estate. And those steps are in specific order because it has to fit that model. You know, my engineering background, everything is about process, and I'm a process-oriented thinking person. And, you know, so step one in my decision-making always comes down to strategy. Like, I tell folks that I have to know what my exit strategy is before I pull the trigger on a property, first and foremost. Got to think that through. Got to know it. Why am I buying it? Am I buying it to rent? Am I buying it to renovate and resell? Am I buying it as a potential wholesale, like you said, where I can just buy the property and I get it at a deep enough discount, and I can add me a little premium to it and sell it to somebody else who might not have as much time to go out there in the streets and look for deals, and there's still enough room for them to make some money off of it, which I think is the art and the it's the value of a good wholesaler is making sure, you know, using that proverbial sentence of leaving meat on the bone, you know, leave enough meat on the bone where the investor can still buy it from you and renovate it or, you know, sell it or hold on to it and still make a cash flow, because they always going to come back to you if you're a wholesaler. So for me, strategy is always step one for me. You know, that determines everything. So what would you say is kind of your, in your process, what's the first step you look at? What is step number one as far as the criteria that the property has to pass before you say, okay, let me get into a deeper analysis of it?
Yeah, so I think you're right. It's, you know, it is about the strategy. And then sometimes, to be quite honest with you, I know very early on, before I do much research, before I even get into my strategy or process, if this is even going to work. And oftentimes when someone sends me a property, and let's say they've evaluated the property at $200,000, and there's no way that I would pay more than $50,000 for that property, right? This is without even doing my analysis, just knowing what I know about the neighborhood, knowing what I know about the conditions, knowing what I know about the resale value, knowing what I know about the age of the property, because the age sometimes, it tells me, would probably need to be done in their worst-case scenario. So if I know it's radiator heating, for instance, and I know that properties at the top of the market are selling with central air, then I already know that I have to rip those radiator heaters out. I already know that I'm going to have to add ductwork. I know I'm probably going to have to open up the floors and ceilings if the property has plaster versus drywall. So all those are considerations. So, but my point is, if they're at 200 and I'm at 50, we are universes apart.
Right.
So before I do too much analysis, because I don't want to waste my time either, because there's only so much time in the day. And so I need to dedicate my time to deals that I think are going to be fruitful and it's a productive use of my time. And so sometimes I see things, it's just not reasonable. And it's okay to say no. I say no to more deals than I say yes to. And that's important because you have a limited amount of resources. So even if you say, well, you know, I'm using my own cash and it's coming from a retirement account, or I got hard money lenders who's, you know, knocking down my door to give me money, so there's not a problem or shortage of money. But, yeah, you got to think about opportunity costs, right? So if you're saying yes to something, you're also saying no to something else. So if you're putting these resources and this money to this particular project, then you are foregoing the potential of other projects, projects that may be more profitable or projects that may fit your criteria. And so you can't just think that there's an unlimited source of resources, right? So you got to think that way, you know, when you're approaching it. But to your point, King, in terms of what am I looking for, is I'm looking at all those things. I'm looking at acquisition costs. I'm looking at the particular neighborhood and the area that the property is located in. What is my strategy? What is my exit strategy, right? So is this a buy and hold? Is this a rent? Is it a wholesale? You know, exactly what it is that I'm trying to accomplish here. And then I try to drill a little deeper than to the numbers. And to I typically have my team that works with me, you know, I refer to it as a 65 rule. And so when I say 65 rule, they understand exactly what we're saying. The baseline of our general approach, and it's not much different than some other investors, but the 65 rule is we're looking to buy 65 cents on the dollar. And so very simple, if a property owner wants $100,000, then we're looking at $65,000 of the market value, right? So $65,000. At that $65,000, we're also looking to back out of our renovation cost. You know, so if it's going to cost me, you know, $20,000 to renovate that property, then it has to be a special reason why I would offer more than $45,000, right? So is this property, you know, 800 square foot larger than the average ones on that block, that neighborhood? What is the uniqueness about this property? But our baseline is 65% of the market value minus repairs. And so people typically say, well, whoa, so you need 40% margins. But the reality is you have to prepare for things that will come up that you don't anticipate. So you don't want to get in it where you're so tight, the margins are so tight where there is no reserve for things happen that you're not anticipating. You also got to factor in the soft costs. So there's going to be permits. There's going to be carrying costs, like once you renovate this property, how long is it going to take to get a buyer, to get a renter? So you're going to have carrying costs. You're going to have utilities. So you're going to be actively writing checks from the time that you purchase the property. So you want to make sure that you have a formula or a strategy that's going to make sure that you have the rate of return that you're looking for on the property. And my approach, as I said, is a 65 rule. You know, other people have other ways that they do it, but that's one that's worked for me over the last 20 years.
Okay. Now, with that being said, over the last 20 years, do you have a preference to what type of residential house that you prefer from an investor standpoint? And what I mean by that is living in the cities of Washington, D.C. and Baltimore City, we have, you know, row houses, you know, basically, mm-hmm. you know, coming from the suburbs in St. Louis, we call those still townhouses, but I know the term is row houses. And I know there's a difference. So either row house or actually semi-detached or a mixed use or a multi-use, you have a particular preference that you prefer, and why not?
Yeah, I mean, for me, King, I think it's all about the portfolio mix, right? I think it's about because you got to keep in mind that when things are well in one market, when things are bad in one market, they tend to be well in other markets. So for me, I've always liked to straddle that commercial property side, so that residential, that commercial property, I like. And so mixed use tend to work well for me. That's something that has retail on the first level that you can rent out to a business owner, and then apartments on the top, because that helps with the stabilization, because you're getting that constant flow of that cash flow. So I like that. I like the mixed use. But in terms of housing styles, not so much, really. I'm looking at really the bones of the house, the square footage, what is the per square foot lease rate, what's the per square foot sale rate. You know, those are the things that are more important. But obviously, you know, what is the appetite, right? What are people looking for in that particular neighborhood and area? So I think those things typically drive what my selections are more than my own personal preference.
Understood. You know, I think it's so much that goes into the strategy, not the strategy, but I'm sorry, the overall process of investing in real estate that a lot of people just don't really understand that. Because you just talked about some of the things that you're mindful of, you know, when it comes to pulling the trigger. Like I go through my list quickly. Like I said, number one is strategy. Number two is neighborhood. You know, neighborhood to me is extremely important. And I say this particularly because right now my focus is definitely Baltimore City. Everybody who's familiar with the Conscious Real Estate Investors Roundtable know that we have a mission and a purpose here in Baltimore City to bring economic revitalization to this city through real estate and business development. So neighborhoods in Baltimore, being a city of neighborhoods, where that's over, depending on who you ask, 220 neighborhoods in this city. And each neighborhood has its own character, its own charm, as it's being Charm City, but it also has its own amenities, its own pros and its own cons. You know, like if you're on the east side and you're in the Oliver neighborhood and you're closer to John Hopkins, so there's pros and cons to that. You know, the pro obviously is the fact that that's a kind of a hot area, so people are buying a property around there, so you know, you can get comps in that area a lot better. Some of the cons are obviously the fact that for me, that area is further from downtown. It's a more difficult to get in and out of downtown from that area. There's still a lot of other neighborhoods or blocks in that area that has a lot of crime around it, because gang activity. So you have to watch and be aware of that. There's a lot of homeless activity in that area, a lot of drug activity in that area. So you got to be aware of that. You know, now I know folks who love Oliver and only invest in Oliver, you know, particularly on Broadway, but there's a limited resource of being able to buy properties actually on Broadway itself. You know, after having lived in East Baltimore, actually on Broadway, and now living and developing in the west side of Baltimore, I actually prefer properties on the west side. They tend to be a little larger. The west side has, in my opinion, better access to county. You can get to the county much faster than you can on the east side. You know, when I say the county, I know it depends on what county. You know, on the east side, you're dealing with Dundalk. You know, on the west side, you're dealing with Catonsville. So depending on which county, which side. But overall, I think one of the other things that moves me on property, number three on my list, is condition. Again, it goes to condition of the property and condition of the neighborhood. You know, those things are important to me to understand the historical difference of what caused this neighborhood to be the way it is. And then also understanding what are the future plans for the city and the city council. And do they intend, you know, we talked about in previous King Street discussions, the master plan and getting the neighborhood master plans, you know. And again, Baltimore City has several different master plans for depending on what neighborhood you want, that you're interested in. Now, the master plan doesn't always give you all the information, because a lot of neighborhoods in Baltimore City have master plans that were written about 15, 20 years ago. A whole lot of ideas never actually came to pass. But it still gives you a range as far as what was planned, and then you can try to figure out why did it not come to pass. Was it because of a change in leadership, such as the city council or the community leaders in that particular neighborhood either died or moved away or was voted out of office? Or was it a change because of outsiding circumstances, like the market conditions change? So I know for a fact that the 2008 housing market, when it crashed, had a huge impact on Baltimore City real estate investing. You know, so that slowed things down. Or then the Freddie Gray uprising, that had an impact on investing in Baltimore City. So those things you can't plan for and don't see coming as quickly, but you have to still be able to pivot and adapt. And so that's where number four comes in, which is price, you know, and what I'm buying these properties for. The price of the actual house, the price of what it's going to cost to renovate it, the price of, you know, the access to capital that I'm buying or utilizing, all that plays a role into my decision-making when it comes to whether or not I'm going to pull the trigger on investment property or not. So those are the top first four things I get into my other full seven list as we continue our dialogue. But I just want to share that with our listening audience that for me, price is number four on my list as opposed to number one. And I say that again because in Baltimore City, to be honest, you can actually get a house for free. Somebody would give you a house, you know, so price is not, you can't be moved by price, you know, and the reason somebody would give you a house is because they have all kind of liens and violations on it, and it's cheaper for them to just give it to you and then as opposed to them trying to sell it and can't get clear title and go through all those things. So that's why I said price is not as important to me as is the neighborhood, as the strategy, and as the condition of that neighborhood and determining whether I want to move on that deal or not. Now, one of the things too, Mr. Smith, I wanted to kind of go a little deeper into something you said before. So you don't necessarily have a preference when it comes down to whether you want a detached house, like a suburban type house, or whether it's an inner city row house. Because the good thing about Baltimore City as well, and D.C. to a certain extent, is that the housing stock in the city itself, within the city parameters, varies. You know, you can get row houses, you can get single detached houses, you can get houses that are, you know, right next to each other and detached, or houses that are semi-detached, you know, depending on what neighborhood you want. Like if you want inner city neighborhoods like Upton, you know, Marble Hill, Reservoir Hill, you're getting straight row houses on the west side. But if you go to areas like on the west side itself, Forest Park, you're going to get a larger single family detached house, you know, pretty large size house. And each one of those presents a unique set of renovation challenges to those. So my question would be, is there anyone that you like, I have more of a preference, my contractor or team is, my construction team is more familiar and more experienced with this type of house as opposed to that type of house? Or again, it's still based off what the numbers look like and what you can, what the property can generate for you?
Yeah, so I think you bring up a good question, King, because oftentimes as investors, we have our personal preference, right, for things that we like. But does that align with what the community and or the end buyer is looking for, right? So can we take our personal preferences and put a return on investment on that? And so we are unique in that we work on both sides of the equation. And so we have a full-service real estate practice, and in that practice we represent developers and we represent investors as well as traditional people who are looking to purchase to live in the property, as well as property management. So I say that to say is because we represent investors who are looking to acquire properties, renovate properties as part of their growth strategy. And we have this conversation with them all the time about, you know, we have investors that we kind of laugh about because it's they love their craft, right? And so these are investors who are also contractors, right? A dangerous combination. Because they fall in love with the process. And so what happens oftentimes is they go in and they start renovating a project, but because they have the skill set, they have the talent, they tend to say, well, I know the scope of work says X, but I'm going to also add Y. And, ooh, wouldn't it be nice if this had Z? Oh, man, this place would be phenomenal with Z. And so what they fail to realize is when they went into the project, they had a budget, and they also had a schedule. And they had ROI or a return on investment that they were looking to make. But the further they get down this line of adding additional amenities and things on the fly, it tends to start to diminish the return on investment, as well as push out the schedule. And so it's not so much the type of house, but it's, as an investor, you have to understand what are the market demands for that type of property, and where you're going to be able to deliver it, where you're going to be able to make your profit. So I had to say that as a segue, because I'm not in most cases emotionally attached necessarily to the properties, although I do have a heart for the community, and I do understand that what we're doing is community development. And so as we're improving these properties, we're doing it so that we can increase, the things that are important to people in terms of quality housing. So I do understand that. But to the expense where we're over-improving, or we're making improvements that are not in correlation with what the market wants and or what people are willing to pay. So I think that's important.
Absolutely right, because you can overdevelop a house. I mean, I've seen in properties where folks have put tray ceilings in houses in neighborhoods where the houses are selling for $80,000. You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's because, to your whole point, they tapped into their artistic talent, and that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to come in because they watched episodes of, Flip a House or any of those reality TV home buying renovation shows, and they want to come in and do that because that taps into their artistic skill set. But without understanding the economics of it, the neighborhood, if you put tray ceilings, can you charge more for this property because it has tray ceilings in it, where if you look at the comps, nobody else in the neighborhood does. So can you get more money out of it because it took you more time to put that in, or recessed lighting, or even finishing the basement? I know a lot of developers here in Baltimore City, they go back and forth on whether or not to finish the basement. And sometimes a lot of these properties, particularly row houses, have cellars, not basements, and cellars are just where you go down steps and it's only 5 feet deep, and you gotta lower your head, so it's not really a full basement. So you would have to excavate that basement at least 3 feet or so. And that's going to require underpinning and quite a bit of work, which may add $20,000 more to the budget. So the question has to be asked, if I add $20,000 to finish a basement, then can I get that back in the sale of the property? So can I sell my property for $20,000 more than what the average comp is selling for in this neighborhood over here? Or if it's not, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and you make a great point, and I don't want to interrupt, but what I want to just make a caveat to what you're saying is, will I get the $20,000 back? Because, again, we're talking about opportunity cost. What is the return on investment? Because if I'm spending $20,000 to put a basement in, that pushes out my construction schedule. That increases my cost. So if I'm only getting $20,000 back, then that's a break-even investment, probably not worth finishing the basement if there isn't going to be a return on investment. So you would, in that scenario, you'd have to be able to get more than $20,000 by improving the basement, because in that case, that's what you spent to improve the basement. Otherwise, you just put yourself further behind in your construction schedule and further behind where you're actually going to be able to sell the property, put it on the market, and get your money back. And, oh, by the way, pay back the bank or whomever you borrowed the money from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Then the flip side argument of that, I've seen houses that folks did not finish a basement, and the house is a 3-bedroom, 1-bath house, and they have been unable to sell it and unable to rent it. Now, I don't know if it's because the basement is not finished, because that's the reason, but I'm just saying that there's pros and cons to that argument. And that's why I say, for me, everything goes down to understanding the neighborhood, understanding the conditions, all that whole process. So you can really, if you master the neighborhood, you understand what type of housing stock is in that neighborhood. It doesn't come down to the specific question of, should I finish a basement or not on a, one particular house, when you over, when you understand the overall housing structure in that whole neighborhood and what people are used to expecting when they live in those neighborhoods.
Right, and I agree with you, King, 100%. And these are conversations that as an investor we should be having before acquisition, right? So we should be sitting with a real estate professional, right, who is looking at the comps, who are looking at the comparables, who can tell you in the last 180 days, because that's the time frame that the appraiser is going to look at, in the last 180 days, what houses have sold, what have been the conditions of those houses, how long did it take to sell those houses, and how does your house differ from those houses that sold. So if 90% of the houses that sold did not have finished basements, right,
right,
and 10% of them had the finished basements, then all things being equal, how much more did the property with the finished basement sell for? Because that's going to give you an idea if it's worth the time and or investment. But if that number is 90-10, then that tells me there's a high demand for properties in that neighborhood without a finished basement. So that tells me the expectation of the buyers who are coming to that neighborhood or that community are coming not expecting finished basements, right? Because 90%
right.
of the housing stock does not have finished basements, right? And then you look at return on investment is, you know, how much more are you going to be able to bring on the market or be able to demand for a finished basement, right? Is it a walkout basement? Or is it below grade? Because now we're getting into an appraisal conversation. That typically appraisals, when they're the appraiser is the one that's going to deliver the value on the property, particularly for the bank who's giving the loan, for the buyer, and they're going to look at comparables over the last 180 days. Well, if the property, if the basement is below grade, right, then and it has a bedroom, for instance, you might say, hey, I added an extra bedroom here, so now I have four bedrooms. All the other houses on the block has three bedrooms, and my basement is finished. Well, if that basement is below grade, meaning below ground level, then that basement, then that bedroom is not going to count as a bedroom. They typically count the bedrooms above grade. So you have to really be able to sit down with a professional who can give you the nuances of pricing, of comparables, so that you have a pretty good idea of what your return on investment is going to be before you go into the project. And acquisition, there's very few numbers that I believe in the equation that are as important as acquisition. And this is the reason why I say that. And people say, oh, well, how can you say that? Because what is your construction budget? And yeah, those things are important, don't get me wrong. But the reason why I think acquisition is one of the most important numbers is because if you don't get that number right and you buy the house for more than you should have bought the house for, you're going to be chasing your tail throughout that whole transaction to try to make that difference up. So when you're negotiating with that contractor, at every aspect of this process, you're going to be trying to regain leverage. Because if you buy too high, you're going to lose leverage. So you're going to be chasing your tail throughout the whole process. That's why I say my 65% rule works, because with that type of margin, I can make up for things that I don't know until after I get into the transaction. But if I'm buying at market value as an investor, and then things don't go the way I anticipated, I'm chasing my tail throughout that whole transaction trying to make myself whole. And in some cases, it's nearly impossible to do.
Now, with your 65% rule, just to make sure that our listening audience is clear, is that 65% of the current market value or 65% of the after repair value?
It's a current market value. Yeah.
Okay, so if a house is currently appraised at or is comping at $100,000, so you're saying that your maximum offer is going to be $65,000 for that particular property.
Yeah, it'd be 65 minus the repairs. Now, it may not be my maximum, because there may be some unique situations where I may be willing to pay more, right? but I have to have a baseline of where I'm starting the conversation because now, again, understand this. Every property is not going to be a fit for my investment strategy.
Right.
So understand that every property is not going to be a fit. So I'm looking for the diamonds in the rough. I'm looking for, you know, a property that someone inherited and they may live out of state. So they no longer want to pay for the upkeep of the property because no one from the family is ever going to come and live in it. I might be looking at a property that hasn't been occupied for 10 to 15 years. So they may have some issues, structural issues. It may have been taken on water. And so I'm looking for properties where we can create a win-win for myself and for the seller. And so I do understand that my strategy may not be for every seller, and that's okay. And that's why I said earlier, as an investor, you have to develop whatever your strategy is, whatever your approach is, and be okay that every conversation is not going to lead to a deal.
Absolutely.
But when it
Absolutely.
Does, and it fits your buying criteria, it fits your strategy as an investor, then you've already set yourself up for success.
Absolutely. Now, do you have a deal that you purchased that went wrong in your mind that you actually lost money on? And if so, can you talk a little bit about that and how did it go wrong? Was it a mistake on the purchase side of it, a mistake on the renovation side of it? Just what was some of the lessons you learned from that?
Oh, man. So many opportunities, right, for lessons. Trying to think of one of the more interesting ones. I got to think back to my 65 rule, we bought a property for about $75,000. The property had not been lived in for several years. The property was taken on water, which we knew. We knew we had to replace the roof. But what we didn't know is that the joists the flooring, everything was just totally saturated. And so as I told you, I knew I had to deal with the roof. What I wasn't anticipating was the floor joists. But guess what? Because the water was running over the side of the house, this was a single family, all the studding had to be ripped out. So can you imagine? So I was having this conversation with my contractor. It was in real time, so I understood what was going on. I was going to the construction site about every 2 days because I was also project managing it. So we're talking through on the phone, you know, what was going on, and I said, okay, cool, I understand that. It's like, oh, well, we're going to have to rip this out. We thought we were going to have to come, you know, 3 feet off of the wall. We're finding that we're going to have to, you know, pretty much take half of the flooring out of that room and then the floor joists. And I said, okay, I understand that. It's like, oh, we had a whole lot of rot in the wall, so we started pulling that back and ended up getting all the way to the studs. So, you know, we're going to have to deal with that. I said, yeah. He said, well, you know about the roof situation. I said, yeah. However, I wasn't prepared that when I got to the job site, now think about this as an investor, I got to the job site, I walk in the house, I could look down and see the dirt, I could look out and see the sun, I could look up and see the sun. So we had pretty much taken this house all the way down, you know, to its foundation studding. And I said, wow. But to your point, had I not bought at the right price, I would have lost my shirt in that. But we bought at the right price, so we were able to do the right thing, right? We didn't do the expedient thing. We didn't do the cheapest thing. We did the right thing. We went in and we did it as if we were going to live there. And so we went in and we used, you know, the right material. We put in the headers. We did the things the right way. But we were able to make a sizable profit off of that sale, even though we probably had about, I don't know, maybe $15,000 to $17,000 of additional expenses that we did not anticipate from the beginning. So that's why I say that it's so key to have a strategy to make sure there's healthy margins in the strategy so that you can account, because you're not going to know everything. Trust me, there's going to be things that's going to come up that there's no way you're going to be able to anticipate. And I'll give you another example. You know, we had done all our due diligence, so we'd done the strategy. We understood what it was going to take to rehab it. We had an idea of who we were going to sell the property to, knew how long it was going to take, had the construction schedule, all those things down. Went to closing, had a title company, did a title search, all the things that's required. Went to closing, contacted the utility companies, as they typically do. What is the payoff? Got the payoff. This was another property, wasn't lived in for a while, so we paid the utility bills. Well, lo and behold, the title attorney calls me 4 days after settlement, and we're swinging hammers in the midst of construction, and said, hey, and I'm like, okay. She said, I think that there is an outstanding water bill. And I'm saying, well, how did that happen? Well, how can there be an outstanding water bill when you called and you made the final reading, you got all the information from the utility company? She said something had fallen through the crack. She said this property was vacant probably for about 2 years, and we think that there may have been a water leak, and we think that water had been running for 2 years in the property. And I said, well, how is that possible? So as we started doing research, what we found out is there was a $65,000 water bill.
Wow.
That the utility company was looking for us to satisfy.
Wow.
And so, you know, there was a lot of finger pointing going on. I will tell you, it was some very spirited conversation that we had with the title attorney. But what I ended up doing was they have a process where you can appeal, which we did, because our point was, you know, there had to be some accountability on the utility company's part, because if you have a meter out there and you're just seeing this meter run for 2 years, at what point will you take some accountability instead of blind billing? Like, who has a $65,000 water bill for a 1,700 square foot house? This is not a commercial building. It's not an apartment building. It's not a laundromat. And so, so we did appeal it. Typically, it takes 90 days for the total appeal process. But I explained to them, hey, I'm an investor. I just settled on this property. You know, we're looking to sell this property in 60 days. You know, I need some grace here. And so they were fortunate, and we were able to work the situation out in about 40 days. And I'm happy to tell you that they did waive that total water bill. I think we had to pay like an administrative fee. We made an administrative fee of about $80. But for the most part, the $65,000 water bill, we were successful in having that waived.
Wow. What a very interesting story. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, No. So you say something that went bad. That's something that went terribly bad.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we got a minute and a half left over in the show. I want to give you an opportunity to share your contact information with our listening audience in case they want to reach out to you and hire you for your services.
Absolutely. So, again, my contact number is 240-317-9444. Again, that's Andre Smith. Our firm is Velocity Real Estate Group. We focus on real estate development, as well as traditional real estate sales, commercial sales and lease, as well as asset and property management. Our website is thevelocitygroupllc.com.
Okay, Mr. Smith, this has been a great show. And for listening audience, this is King with King Street. Again, I represent the Conscious Real Estate Investors Roundtable. You go to our website at www.consciousrt.com, and conscious is spelled CONSCIOUSR, as in round, T as in table.com. You can find out all our latest information. We're shifting to an all virtual environment, so look for next week where we're going to be having virtual classes. Mrs. Smith and I are going to be doing several different real estate classes and webinars that we'll get more information out to you all. You can also find us on Facebook by looking for Conscious Roundtable as well. And I want to thank everybody for listening. This has been King Street, and everybody continue to be safe and sound. And until next time, let's all continue to be more conscious.